But why don't we start? I don't know what are the questions that you've got. I'll be assuming to a certain extent a GCSC working knowledge of evolutionary theory. Maybe that covers all of us. If it doesn't, don't worry. I'm hoping to bring in illustrations as I go to try and explain things. It will be a bit philosophical because I think we need to sharpen up our critical thinking skills. So I will be talking about philosophical concepts and philosophical terms. But the title of this evening is Darwin, Dawkins, and God. Three questions I want us to think about this evening. First of all, what is science? What kind of thing is it? What can it tell us? Can the men and women in white coats tell us everything we need to know in life? Or is there knowledge elsewhere that is equally reliable, equally true? And can it legitimately prevent belief? I'm sure we're all aware in our society that if a scientist says something is true, we're inclined to believe it. Can a scientist dissuade us from belief in a deity, a god? So that's the first question, what is science? Second question, what is evolution? Is it science? Can we put evolution in the same box as Boyle's gas laws or gravitational laws? Can evolution be used for atheism? Is it a support to the belief that there is no God? And then final question I want to think is about is how is faith possible? For some of us here, we'll be committed Christians or examining the Christian faith. How does our faith relate to this question? What is science? Just an illustration to begin with. Imagine that over coffee or a glass of wine or orange juice, whatever, I start to get into conversation with you afterwards. And as we're chatting, I say, well, it'd be really great to get to know you a little bit better. Could I have a cheek sample, please, and some hair? I just want to go away and do a bit of analysis. Would that encourage you to get to know me better? Probably not. In other words, there's a category confusion going on there, isn't it? If that's how I think relationships work, if I'm turning to science for input on how I would get to know somebody a bit better, I've made a category confusion. All well and good when it comes to going to the doctor, when it comes to medicine, but it is there a realm of knowledge which we are all committed to and believe in, which is outside science. And if God is a person and we relate to God in a similar way to the way we relate to other people, then is it actually inappropriate to consider proving or disproving him in a scientific manner, doing an experiment, putting him under a microscope, taking a sample? That's the question we're thinking about. What is science? Here's a definition from a philosopher of science. He would define science as an inductive, empirical, quantitative, mechanistic observation of nature. It's a good definition. Inductive. We reason from the general to the particular. We look out in the world around us and we say, well, this planet goes around that star and this planet goes around that star, and well, therefore we can calculate certain generalities from those two observations, and we assume that it is the same throughout the whole universe. We haven't observed what happens to all planets around all stars, but we assume by inductive reasoning that that is the case. Empirical, it's to do with what we can sense or measure. It's quantitative. We want to see the relationship between two things. Mechanistic, it's to do with the how question rather than the why question, and it's all obviously to do with nature. So what do some famous scientists think of that definition? Erwin Schrödinger would agree with it. Science is very usually branded as being atheistic. After what we have said, this is not astonishing. If its world picture does not contain beauty and delight, sorrow, if personality is cut out of it by agreement, how should it contain the most sublime idea that presents itself to the human mind? What he's saying is if you exclude any personal explanation from science, the idea that there's a God, you exclude personality or emotion from it, then you can't disprove that by the time you've ended up completing your scientific experiments. So Schrödinger would agree with that. Science has limits. Can't tell us anything about beauty or delight, sorrow or God. An atheist, Stephen Jay Gould, would also agree. Science simply cannot, by its legitimate methods, adjudicate the issue of God's possible superintendence of nature. We neither affirm nor deny it. We simply can't comment on it as scientists. I'm sure we've all heard of Schrödinger. I'm sure we've all heard of Stephen Jay Gould, one of the most famous paleontologists of the last century. Both of you would say science has limits. It can't tell us about God. And therefore, it is not the same as empirical knowledge. Empiricism is bigger than science. What do I mean by empiricism? Empiricism is just the things that we can rely on, the sense data that comes into our perception, which many would say is real and believes to be real in science. But, for example, history. Or, you know, did England beat Sri Lanka or not? That's based on empirical sense data. Science is not the only thing that is empirical. So, for example, you can't do a scientific experiment on whether the Spanish Armada happened or how it happened. That is the realm of history. It's no less reliable, no less rational. There's a discipline in how you would go about finding out what happened in the Spanish Armada. But you can't do a scientific experiment. Science has a limit in what it can tell us in its certainty. It's not to deny that there's scientific laws going on, the wind and the waves and gravity and all that kind of thing. But science is not history. We do have access to reliable, rational knowledge, which is not science, some of the most famous scientists would assert. And science has beliefs. So let's just put to bed this idea that science is somehow a body of knowledge which has no faith within it, and there's no such thing as belief within science. Peter Harrison, the professor of science and religion at Oxford University, would say that it began in a Christian milieu, science as we know it today, for example with Robert Boyle and his gas laws, who founded the Royal Society, who was a committed Bible-believing Christian. It was religious in nature. Newton thought his theological works were more important than his Principia. And the Christian community of the time fostered it through three main beliefs which gave rise to science. Firstly, that man needs to increase in understanding and power over reality. In other words, things aren't the way they should be. We've lost knowledge that we should have. Let's get it back. A restoration of this understanding can come because of redemption. Matter is essentially good, therefore we can investigate it to get power over it. And the truth about the universe is accessible to human reason because it's made by an analogous mind. There is a mind behind the universe, Christians believe, and that's what gave rise to the scientific endeavor at that time. Now, Einstein becomes a bit of a football in this whole debate, doesn't he? So it's worth just defining clearly what he said, or looking clearly at what he said, because this would be similar to Einstein's belief. And we'll see that some of the things that Richard Dawkins says in The God Delusion are simply misquotations. Certain it is that the conviction akin to religious feeling or the rationality or the intelligibility of the world lies behind all scientific work of a higher order. This firm belief, a belief bound up with deep feeling in what? In a superior mind that reveals itself in the world of experience, represents my conception of God. Now, he wasn't a Christian. He wasn't even necessarily a theist. He said he believed in Spinoza's God, a kind of pantheism. But he believed in a mind, and he would say that all science of a high order believes in a mind behind the universe. I am not an atheist, he says, and I don't think I can call myself a pantheist. Sorry, I got that wrong. It is kind of pantheistic, though, Spinoza. We are in the position of a little child entering a huge library of books in many languages. The child knows someone must have written these books. It does not know how. Now, this is Einstein being quoted. Some of the leading physicists of today, though, say the same thing. I cannot believe, says Paul Davies, that our existence in this universe is a mere quirk of fate, an accident of history, an incidental blip in the great cosmic drama. Our involvement is too intimate. Through conscious beings, the universe has generated self-awareness. This can be no trivial detail, no minor byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces. We are truly meant to be here. Now again, he's not a Christian. He wouldn't even describe himself as a theist, but what he's saying is science leads him to believe that there is a mind behind the universe. One of the most famous philosophers of the last century, some would say the leading atheistic philosopher of the last century, was a guy called Anthony Flew, and this is what he says. The leaders of science over the last 100 years, along with some of today's most influential scientists, have built a philosophically compelling vision of a rational universe that sprang from a divine mind. As it happens, this is the particular view of the world that I now find to be the soundest philosophical explanation of a multitude of phenomena encountered by scientists and lay people alike. So he's moved from atheism to embrace a kind of theism. He wouldn't describe himself as a Christian, though. So what I'm arguing is that science, by its very nature and its beliefs, cannot be incompatible with belief in a God. It can't by its methodology. It can't because it has beliefs, therefore faith is something which even science has. And if we look at science itself, we can also tell that it should know that it has limits. A bit of biology, a little bit of physics. So there's some pictures up here. One is supposed to be of an atom with electrons whizzing around it. If we look at how things work at the atomic level and quantum physics, it's a very strange world. Things work in a very weird way, dependent on the observer, Schrodinger's cat, all that kind of thing. For those of you who don't know what that is, the observer seems to affect what happens when you do experiments at the very small level. But there's a certain set of laws at the quantum level. Okay, you go to the level of the leaf now. It's not to say that those laws at the quantum level aren't true, but they're just not applicable when it comes to understanding how a leaf works. We don't need to go into quantum physics. So the theories and laws that work at one level are irrelevant at the next level up. Now, maybe we go to the ecology of the rainforest. Well, who in their right mind would start to try and apply what we know about an individual leaf in trying to understand how ecological interrelationships work in the rainforest? No. There's a different set of laws. And then science is useless when it comes to trying to argue that this highly evolved species should not be eradicating other species. That's just something you cannot argue scientifically. And yet, most of us, I think, would agree that it is a wrong thing to lead to mass extinction in the rainforest. But you can't argue that from science. So even what we know in science is that there are different levels of knowledge. There are limits even to particular laws and how useful they are at explaining things. Therefore, it doesn't necessarily mean that there can't be a higher explanation above all these, which unites all. Now, Stephen Hawking does hint at this in his book, The Grand Design, that there are different areas of explanation. But of course, scientists believe, without having actual experiments that we can do yet, that these will be able to be united, because we believe in a mind that unites all these different areas. I'll be recommending books as I go. There's a very good riposte to Stephen Hawking's claim that this kind of physics denies the existence of God by the professor of mathematics at Oxford University, a guy called John Lennox. So you can have a look at that later. So what I'm trying to argue is that science has limits. It can't deny the existence of a God. And science is not always objective. I grew up in a scientific household. My father was a lifelong scientist. My sister is a PhD scientist doing applied work in the North Sea. Our family sort of lived, breathed, ate science. But it also lived, breathed, and ate the politics of science. So-and-so who would not accept that their theory had been overturned and clung to it because their whole academic life they had invested in this particular theory. They wouldn't accept contrary evidence. You see, science is done by human beings, and therefore it's not always objective. And Kuhn, a philosopher of science, recognized this. He saw science to progress through revolutions because observations which would contradict current theory would be ignored because, well, they contradicted current theory. And you could go for hundreds of years with even what was right in front of people's eyes being ignored because it contradicted the theories that they had. Two examples would be phlogiston and ether. So science does not mean that we have to jettison belief in God. And some of the greatest contemporary scientists have been Christians. Francis Collins, leader of the Human Genome Project. Some of the greatest science in the last century, even evolutionary biologists, have been Christians. Richard Dawkins described R.A. Fisher as the greatest of Darwin's successors. Now, that's quite an accolade. He was a Christian. But what about Darwin himself? Surely if there was anyone who understood evolution, anyone of genius of mind, what was his view? This was a letter he wrote 3 days before he died to a private friend. He had no gallery that he was playing for. This was no politically motivated letter. It was just from one friend to another. It seems to be absurd to doubt that a man may be an ardent theist, that's somebody who believes in God, and an evolutionist. In my most extreme fluctuations, I have never been an atheist, in the sense of denying the existence of a God. Now, unless he changed his mind in those last 3 days, that was his position. So what is science? It's limited. Can it legitimately prevent belief in God? No. Because, why? Well, science, its methodology and its assumptions cannot prevent belief in God. Its origin and history. And great scientists have believed in God or seen no incompatibility between believing in both evolution and all scientific endeavor and the existence of a God. So what about evolution? Now, what I've tried to do is summarize Richard Dawkins' arguments in all his works. I haven't read all of them, but most of them. And I think his argument is something like this, in The God Delusion, in Selfish Gene, wherever. I think his argument goes something like this. Science is the only reliable, rational knowledge. So if you've been influenced by the argument that I've just given, that may not be the case. Therefore, his whole argument would fall. He relies on science being the only reliable rational knowledge. Science can know everything by the simplest explanation. Occam's razor is just a sort of philosophical tool. We know what science tells us in the simplest way. That is what is true. Evolution is science. So, given what's gone before, evolution can explain everything reliably. And that is clearly what Richard Dawkins believes. So God is not necessary as an explanation. Now, I hope I've weakened the first two. I'm going to try and go on and weaken the last three. Two predictions of Darwin's scientific theory of evolution by natural selection. Any scientific theory must have a prediction that is then proven with overwhelming evidence. Two predictions that Darwin talks about in his Origin of Species. First, inheritance will work in small units. Second, the fossil record will be continuous. Anybody tell me who that is? Sorry, this is not, you know. That is Gregor Mendel. And an elegant experiment which he did to prove that inheritance works in a particular way. It's not like paint being blended. They're units. Now we know what those units are now, and it's led to the whole science of genetics and exploration into how particular genes affect all aspects of life. But evolution is also full of history. And as we've seen, my argument is that history is different to science. You cannot apply science to a historical event. Yes, there's aspects within that event which we can understand scientifically, but to take just one example, many believe now that the reason why the dinosaurs went extinct was because of an asteroid impact at the KT boundary, the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, about 65 million years ago. Now, that event is a great example because it really doesn't matter how well the dinosaurs are evolved, how fit they are at eating other dinosaurs or at eating vegetation. It doesn't matter how good they are. Because if an asteroid lands on your head, it really is irrelevant. And if we look back on the history of our world and the universe, if cataclysmic events are more significant than natural selection, then that is one of the key reasons why things are the way they are, not necessarily evolution by natural selection. This was Stephen Jay Gould's, an atheist, paleontologist's view of the fossil record. He came up with a theory called punctuated equilibria, in which evolution seems to go for a bit and then it just doesn't do anything for millions of years and then it changes a bit. Why? Well, he would argue because of these cataclysmic events which determine which things survive and which don't. What I'm arguing is that the fossil record is not nearly as impressive as those who would say that it's all sewn up would Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. I'm getting myself into a knot there, aren't I? What I'm arguing is that the fossil record is not nearly as complete as people might argue. This is George Gaylord Simpson, again an atheist, but who denied that the fossil record supported Darwin's theory. They are not, as a rule, led up to by a sequence of almost imperceptibly changing forerunners, such as Darwin believed should be usual in evolution. It's the prediction that evolution should be complete, the fossil record should be gradual, that we should see a complete record. A great many sequences of two or a few temporally integrating species are known, but even at this level, most species appear without known immediate ancestors. Now, just to throw some sort of thinking into that, here's Simon Conway Morris. He's a professor of evolutionary paleobiology in the Department of Earth Sciences at Cambridge. He's a Christian. He disagrees with those who deny that the fossil record is incomplete. So, Stephen Jay Gould. In other words, there is debate on this issue. There is debate on how reliable the fossil record is. Atheist and Christian can take the same opposing stances. And if you just think about it for a moment, if we were to summarize the fossil record as a 1,000-page book, we don't know, as a record of the history of life on Earth, we don't know whether we have one page, two page, 10 pages. We just don't know. But the best guess is that we've got very, very few pages, because if you think about it, anything that is recorded in this book, The Fossil Record, must have died in water and been buried quickly. I don't know if you've ever been crabbing and you've put some bacon down into the sea. Yeah, or I don't know, it's a bit of fish. They're there pretty quickly, aren't they? They're there pretty quickly because anything that dies in the sea is very rapidly eaten. So the only way that fossils are going to be formed, even in marine environments, is they have to be buried rapidly. That doesn't happen most of the time. The fossil record is, even by basic paleontological textbooks, they just don't know how much it has recorded. And yet some would build a whole philosophy of life on the basis of the fossil record. There's huge gaps. There's just one example, the closest known ancestor to Archaeopteryx. There's a diagram which shows the dotted lines are the bits where we don't have fossils. The sort of solid blobs are the bits where we do. And yet the dotted lines are the evolutionary relationships which are predicted by Darwin's theory. Gary Larson, I'm a great fan of Gary Larson. He was a friend of Stephen Jay Gould. That's just in sort of, if I've lost you completely, sorry. There's a cartoon which summarizes what Stephen Jay Gould and others were saying about Darwinian evolution. It just seems to happen when nobody's watching, when there's no fossils being made. And the more you go on and on and on and on, and the fossils are found in existing groups, the less convincing is Darwin's theory. There's other objections to Darwin's theory by modern scientists. Here's the example of Professor Colin Reeves at Coventry University, but there's hundreds of PhD scientists across the world who question Darwin's theory and its ability to explain the complexity we see in the cell. That looks like a scientist, doesn't it? Don't you think? Slightly mad, slightly sort of back to the future, mad scientist. Forgive me for those of you who are scientists. But even this year, new ideas are coming forth as to how we explain certain genetic mechanisms that change variation, that bring back to the fore Lamarck's theories. And there's neo-Lamarckians starting to say, well, so somehow our environment will change the kinds of genes that are expressed. We can see that, and we can experiment that is the case. So, is evolution atheistic? Does evolution have science and the weight of science to prove atheism? No. I think, and again, obviously, some of you will disagree, if science is not the only rational knowledge, if science, yes, it can know everything by the simplest explanation, but if evolution isn't completely science because it's got this historical component to it, and the witness to that history is so poor that we really don't know how much of a witness we have, well, then evolution cannot explain everything reliably. And God is a potential explanation of the reality we all experience. What is science? Limited? Is evolution science? Well, yes and no. Can evolution therefore be used for atheism, not as science? In other words, if there are different areas of knowledge, and science can't tell us everything about every area of knowledge, then there's some things that we can know truly which science has nothing to say about. So we go to the men and women in white coats and we ask them, what can you tell us about God? They should say, sorry, nothing at all if God is a person. Oh, we can tell you lots about God if God is a physical entity within the universe which we can do experiments on and make predictions. But if he is a person, no, I'm sorry, we don't deal in that. We exclude personality a priori before we even begin our scientific experiments. It would be like going to, I don't know if you've had this experience, going to a foreign country, and in some foreign countries, you ask somebody for directions, and the culture is such that people will always give you directions, whether they know or not. It's just too embarrassing. It's too embarrassing to acknowledge that you don't know something. So they say, oh, yes, well, you go down there, and so off you toddle. And they had no idea. No idea what they were saying. They were just saying something because they didn't want not to know. Is the same going on with scientists? They don't want not to know, so they have to say something on this question of God. But I want to suggest that in Dawkins and the new atheists' approach to life, they are claiming, and Dawkins, I think, does claim, that evolution can explain everything. And I'll seek to demonstrate that from his book, The Selfish Gene, which really is his sort of magnum opus, which is then explained and explicated throughout all the other works that he's written. So love, you see, according to evolutionary ideology, i.e. the view that evolution can explain everything, is just actually selfishness in disguise. So sorry, those of you who are married. Sorry, those of you who have good relationships with your parents. Sorry, those of you who have good friendships. The love that you have is really selfishness in disguise, because we are survival machines, but we do not just mean people. It embraces all animals, plants, bacteria, and viruses. Adultery. Well, we would expect there will normally be some evolutionary pressure on males to invest a little bit less in each child and to try and have more children by different wives. I am treating a mother as a machine programmed to do everything in its power to propagate copies of the genes which reside inside it. Now, this would have some insight, maybe, but remember what Dawkins is claiming is that evolution, this explanation, is the sum total of the explanations that we have. We can't go elsewhere. There is no other rational, reliable knowledge. This is the only knowledge we have, according to Richard Dawkins. Obviously, he considers the idea of God. We do not know how it arose in the meme pool. Probably it arose many times by independent mutation. Memes are a theoretical equivalent in the mind of genes in the body. So in seeking to explain all thought by evolutionary terms, Dawkins has come up with this idea of the meme. And so God is just a meme that infects people's minds. So sorry if you're a Christian here this evening, you've been infected by the God virus. And those of you who like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, used as a call sign, then to that extent it deserves to be called a meme. Or Darwin's theory. There is some essence of Darwinism which is present in the head of every individual who understands the theory. Or hell. Well, the idea of hell is self-perpetuating because of its own deep psychological impact. Faith. Memes for blind faith have their own ways of propagating themselves. Thought. So what's going on here this evening, according to an evolutionist's view of the world, is that co-adapted meme complexes evolving in the same kind of way as co-adapted gene complexes. In other words, it's just competition in your mind by various viruses which have infected it. And where evolution tends to take people is that because it's the only explanation of reality, there is no love, because love is just selfishness in disguise. There is no beauty, because beauty is just a different way of propagating your genes. Flowers are beautiful just because that makes them good at attracting insects. All beauty in the world is just functional. There is no good or evil, because good or evil are just different ways of surviving. He's very clear about this. Cheating, adultery, murder is just a different strategy of survival to not cheating, not murdering, and not committing adultery. They're just different strategies for survival. If it works for you, go for it. If you've got more offspring because of it, there is no good or evil. There is no justice. Well, because there is no good or evil. There is no purpose. All these things are illusions. Now, obviously, many of us would protest at a universe with no love in it. But Richard Dawkins would riposte, well, if science is the only knowledge, and evolution is science, and evolution is the sum explanation, then you have to just get over it. Grow up. But few can live like that. And I've had friends who have tried, and it hasn't taken them to a very healthy place. And in our world, those who have sought to enforce similar ideologies, atheistic ideologies, have not led their nations or their peoples to a very healthy place either. Communism is an atheistic ideology. I think that could be easily proven. Hitler had an atheistic ideology. Now, I know that there are many terrible and wicked things that have been done in the name of religion, not least Christianity, although I think it comes out the best of all world religions. That's a controversial statement, maybe. But let's just look at atheism. And I just want to prove that Hitler had an atheistic evolutionary ideology. So this is from Mein Kampf, not probably read that much nowadays. In the struggle for daily bread, all those who are weak and sickly or less determined succumb, while the struggle of the males for the female grants the right or opportunity to propagate only to the healthiest, and struggle is always a means for improving a species' health and power of resistance, and therefore a cause of its higher development. Hitler hated Christianity. He banned all Bibles and crosses from all churches and replaced the Bible with this book, My Struggle, Mein Kampf. So I think we can argue that atheistic ideology is not innocent, as Richard Dawkins would say in his book, The God Delusion. Because if we just go on headcount, then, well, Mao, that's about 70 million. Stalin, that's about 30 million. The world wars, well, at least 100 million, probably 50 to 70. Pol Pot, 7 million. You get my drift. Where are we up to? And we've probably got a few more minutes before there's that opportunity to write questions that are burning inside you. Some will say that the options are either evolution or six-day creation, that you can't be a Christian who accepts the Bible and also believe in evolution. Well, many, many people who accept the Bible as God's authoritative word also accept evolution. I have respect for those who have a different position and are six-day creationists. At least they want to take the Bible seriously. I'm not a six-day creationist. I believe in evolution and in the inerrancy of the Bible. But even in the days when Darwin proposed his theory, it was the scientists, not the church, who rejected his theory. Cuvier, one of the greatest classicists of the 19th century, did not like Darwin's theory because he saw that animals fit into discrete entities, discrete general in terms of classification. They're all in one or the other. But if Darwin's theory is correct, there should be this sort of vast splurge. But the Christians did accept his theory. Bishop of Oxford, Wilberforce, descended from William Wilberforce, who abolished the slave trade. And those who at that time styled themselves as fundamentalists. Now, don't worry, they're different to the fundamentalists of today. Those who wanted to stand on the authority of the Bible, B.B. Warfield being the chief amongst them, described himself as the Darwinist of the purest water. So where have we got to? Science is limited. It cannot legitimately prevent belief in God. Is evolution science? Well, yes, it has aspects which are scientific, but aspects which fit into the realm of historical interpretation. So evolution cannot be used for atheism, not if it remains its credentials as scientific. But as we've seen, evolution can be inflated to become an ideology which doesn't have science as a basis for that, cannot be proven by science, and such evolutionary ideologies have led to great evils in the last century. Now, time for questions. I know I've gone very fast, but we've done about 35 minutes. So if you've got any questions, just a small break, and then I'm going to come back and look at faith and how somebody who accepts evolution can believe in the God of the Bible. I'm not going to take questions from the floor now. We'll do that at the end of the presentation. But if you'd just like to write questions down now, things that have sprung to mind, things that you are itching to get back at me over, then do write them down. So grab a pen and paper, don't be shy. Jot down any question you might want. Well, great to hear you all chatting away. I hope you're going to continue chatting and discussing things. What I'm going to do now, just to say, if you've got questions written down that you want me to deal with later on or to attempt an answer, but let's continue, and we can continue questions and discussions in open debate later. But I just want to present a reason for faith, if you like. For some of us, it may be that we're investigating Christian things. Others of us may be quite opposed to Christian things and think that Christianity as a system, as a worldview, has got lots of holes in it. And maybe we haven't heard a cogent response to some of the things that Richard Dawkins and other of, new atheists are saying. So how is faith possible? I guess faith is a slippery term, because if it's not defined, we can mean different things by faith, just as we can mean different things by evolution. So it's worth defining terms, because in one sense, we all have faith. We all have trust in other people. We trust what other people tell us is reality about the world. We haven't found out all these things for ourselves. We have trusted in what other people of authority have told us, teachers, scientists, whoever else it might be. In another sense, we have faith in we have relationships with people. We trust people on the basis of relational evidence, which is a very different kind of evidence to trusting that the Earth goes around the sun, even though we haven't seen it physically with our own eyes. So what about faith, Christian faith? Well, Christian faith is based on the historical accuracy of the New Testament and the existence of the man Jesus Christ, who we can go to non-Christian sources as a person who did actually exist. And I think it's the inaccuracy of the New Testament that's certainly been exaggerated in the God Delusion and many other works of the new atheists. Over the last 200 years, the textual criticism that's been done on the New Testament is rigorous, and we are left with a Greek New Testament. We can know how accurate it is. We can measure how accurate it is. We know that 98% of what we read was actually written by the apostles, those who witnessed Jesus' life. People talk about the Gnostic Gospels, you know, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Thomas, but they're at least 150, if not 200 years later than even the most skeptical dating of the New Testament. So that's the first. It's a historical investigation. Christian faith is based on that empirical knowledge, not science, on history. Similarly, the historical claim of the resurrection. So it does rest on, for example, John's claim in his gospel that he saw Jesus dead and he saw Jesus raised bodily alive again. That's the evidence, if you like, that Christians point to for their faith. So it's not an irrational faith. It's not a faith which has no empirical verification. And there have been many instances of those who've set out to disprove, as atheists, disprove the resurrection, and ended up believing it for themselves. You see, scientific reasoning doesn't necessarily work when it comes to the potential of miracle or personal encounters which change people. So if I was to ask you the question, if you fell from 33,000 feet from an aeroplane, could you survive? Well, it is possible. It has happened, but according to the laws of science, we'd say, well, of course not. If you were to fall from the Empire State Building, would you survive? Scientifically, of course not. But again, it's happened. In other words, historical verification is a different thing to scientific verification, and we shouldn't confuse the two, as, and here I'm being very brave, David Hume did, who was a philosopher. And the other evidence that Christians rely on is a personal history. So there may be people here who would say they have encountered a God who is real. They may have been atheists or Muslims or Buddhists or humanists or whoever, but they've encountered God. They weren't expecting. Can't be explained in psychological terms. And they have a sense of personal forgiveness and a hope of eternal life. And they're as real to them as any other relationship. C.S. Lewis is a famous example, who describes himself as the most reluctant convert in all England. As a former atheist, he had to bow the knee. and pray to Jesus, because the evidence in his own life was simply overwhelming. So that's the basis of Christian faith. And I want to say a brief word on what the evidence is not. It's not on a God of the gaps. This is a guy called William Paley, who famously argued that because we can see design in the universe, there must be a designer. He was not a Christian. He was a deist. And he wanted to argue for God in philosophical terms, which many Christians think are very weak. Now, he's always quoted as sort of God of the gaps. Christians believe in a God of the gaps. Well, no. Christians believe in a God of the gasp, if you'll forgive the deliberate rearrangement of the letters. Not a God of the gaps, but a God of the gasp, which I would suggest we all experience. Even Richard Dawkins would say he experiences this feeling. I think that when you consider the beauty of the world and you wonder how it came to be, what it is, you are naturally overwhelmed with a feeling of awe, a feeling of admiration, and you almost feel a desire to worship something. I feel this. I recognize that other scientists, such as Carl Sagan, who's a famous atheist scientist, Einstein felt it. We, all of us, share a kind of religious reverence for the beauties of the universe, for the complexity of life, for the sheer magnitude of the cosmos, the clear magnitude of geological time. And it's tempting to translate that feeling of awe and worship into a desire to worship a particular thing, a particular person. Well, some of us have given in to that temptation, but at least he feels it, which is what you'd expect, isn't it, if there is a God who communicates his existence to everybody, even the atheist. But the Christian case for trusting that God is the God who has created this whole universe is a gasp at beauty. I don't know what it is for you. For me, it was diatoms. Yeah, that's pretty sad, isn't it? But you find these things at the bottom of a pond, and you put them under the microscope, and they're just beautiful. Or it might be the mathematical patterns we see in nature or the universe. Or it might be beautiful things like this kingfisher. It's a very good killing machine, but it also happens to be beautiful. Why does it have to be beautiful? We cannot deny that things are beautiful, and it's not good enough to say, well, it just makes it good at getting lady or husband or, you know, the opposite sex kingfisher, because it doesn't. You can't fully explain that in those terms. That was God of the gaps. Got to get rid of that. We gasp at beauty. And Christians gasp at beauty, which they see has come from the artist, the great artist of the universe. Their heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. And then in part of the New Testament, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men, generically, are without excuse. In other words, this is a message we all get. We all encounter beauty and we're led to awe and wonder at it. But we all gasp at evil as well. And this is the other plank of the Christian argument for the existence of God, is that when we see nature and when we see things happen in our world, we react differently to the animals. It's not just predation and how cruel and callous it is. When something happens in the news, like Baby P, whatever it was a few years ago, we don't say, well, that's what you'd expect from a non-biological father. You'd expect a non-biological father to shake the baby to death. Well, I mean, that's what lions do. You see, when a lion takes over a new pride, the male lion goes around and kills all the infants so that all the other females come onto reproductive potential earlier and therefore it will get more offspring. No, that's just what you'd expect. No, we recoil and we call it evil. But these aren't terms which evolutionary biology accepts. But we believe in them, don't we? Or at least I hope we do. Or the Holocaust. We don't sort of say, well, it's what you'd expect, one race competing against another race. Survival of the fittest. We gasp at it. It touches something deep inside because the Bible would say that we're made like God, who is good and hates evil, is angry about evil. And this reaction, if you like, is recorded at least 3,000 years ago by Solomon. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is meaningless. All go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all return. Who knows if the spirit of man rises upwards and if the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth? He's making an observation about what our world is like. And this is what it's like. People's bodies are littered like refuse over the earth. But we don't just say, well, that's just the way things are. Solomon's reaction was, because I'm reacting this way, there must be an ultimate justice. This is wrong, it's evil, it's bad, it can't be right. So his conclusion was this, which is very different to the conclusion of New Atheism. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. And you might say, well, judgment, that's all a bit primitive, John, isn't it? Well, it's what Jesus taught a lot about. As a good thing, that our world is heading to being mended, to being a just place where evil things don't happen anymore. And the key was what Jesus did on the cross. And I guess this is where many Christians find faith. It's understanding the good news of what Jesus did do on the cross. Because the Christian faith, yes, it's got a historical basis in both the text of the New Testament and in the historicity of the resurrection. A number of us here could testify to historical, personal happenings in our lives which have led us to faith. But fundamentally, it's a belief that God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in Jesus and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. In other words, the God that Christians trust and believe in is a God who is going to put this world back together, who can forgive people like you and me, who don't really want to live as if he's there, and bring us into a world where everything is made so it isn't evil anymore, where suffering has ended. And the reason why we react against those things is because we're made for a relationship with God. Okay, sorry to cut in on lots of conversations. I'm sure we can carry those on. It'd be good to give us ourselves a significant time for questions and debate, but what I'd like to do first is answer the questions, really in the order of my presentation. So first of all, looking at science, then evolution, and then Christian faith. Hasn't the problem of religion, and particularly Christianity, been that it has historically said it commandeered the truth and has since Copernicus and Galileo always been fighting a rearguard retreat in the advance of science? I think a couple of things to be said. Obviously, Copernicus and Galileo were themselves Christians and weren't necessarily motivated by an anti-Christian or suppressed by the church as those who weren't Christians. So they were Christians seeking to understand God's world, motivated in many ways by their belief. But it is true to say that some aspects of the church have suppressed scientific endeavor, which is why the Reformation was so important in that it established two principles, really. The first was that we're all responsible before God for understanding for ourselves what the Bible says. We're not to give that authority to the church as a group of people, because then the church as a group of people, if they decide what God says, they have huge power, and if they decide that certain scientific endeavor is not right, then similarly they can suppress it. So the Reformation, I think, was instrumental in freeing people from the authority of the church in that sense, and yet also the early scientists who set up the Royal Society, people like Robert Boyle and others, were motivated by their Christian faith in progressing science. I think it's also worth saying that before the Reformation, there was a lot of groundwork done by monks and others which established a philosophical basis for science. So even Darwin himself said, I'm just trying to get this vaguely right, he would say something like, I progressed according to Baconian principles. Now, Roger Bacon was a monk in the 12th century who established a philosophical approach to understanding what nature was. And so, in a sense, you've got some Christians doing some work philosophically, which then Darwin himself relied upon. So I think it's a bit of a myth to say that Christians have always stood against the advance of science, but clearly the church has points in history. Now, right of reply, I think that's only fair, isn't it? If people want to come back at me, what do I say? That's absolutely fine. So I'll pause after every question, because I wouldn't want to not answer the question or misunderstand the question. Also gives me a chance to think about the next one. My definition of science would involve repeatability in demonstrating a concept, sound like Hooke's law or gravity. How can evolution as science be tested in this way? Well, there's certain aspects of evolution which can be observed. So speciation events have occurred. Polyploidy, which is where plants pollinate, one plant pollinates another and their chromosome number doubles, thus creating a new species in one single pollination event. So we can see that new species arise, and that's one of the tenets of Darwin's theory, that species aren't individually created, but they are arising. How can we test it along those terms? I would say that genetic experiments have proven aspects of natural selection, gene frequency, gene flow, that kind of thing, which is a plank, if you like, in the new doctrine, the neo-Darwinism, new Darwinism. But in that sense, no, evolution cannot be proved by repeated experiments, but it can progress according to predictions, which then are validated by observation. So if you say this theory predicts this, we will see this, and then you see that, that is evidence for that theory. So when Darwin's theory predicts particulate inheritance or the science of genetics and a continuous fossil record, and the fossil record isn't continuous, and actually some geneticists are now thinking, well, how can all this complexity arise purely by natural selection? Then because your prediction hasn't come true and there's been 150 years for the prediction to be verified in a watertight sense, because we've got lots and lots and lots of fossils now, then it's evidence against that. So you can't do experiments, but you can make predictions which are then either confirmed by observations or the observations contradicted. So, I mean, the physicists amongst us will be able to tell us what Einstein's theory predicted, and then we observe the reality of those predictions, like light bending around the sun or things like that. Does that answer that question? Yeah, sorry if I've made myself difficult to understand in that I'm not arguing for no evolution as in new species arising over time. I accept that. What I'm saying is that Darwin's theory, in which new species arise, new families, etc., solely by means of natural selection, is in doubt, because you'd expect fossils to come in every... So say you've got that little lizard here, and you've got Archaeopteryx, or sort of proto-birds here. If Darwin's theory is correct, you would expect to see fossils of slow, gradual change. Lots of intermediate, lots and lots and lots. Not just all the fossils fit into this category, and then all the fossils fit into this category. And if every fossil you dig up, by and large, fits into this category or this category, and you're expecting and longing for lots and lots and lots of fossils in between, then it seems to suggest a different kind of mechanism for evolution. So I'm not saying that evolution hasn't happened. I'm saying evolution by Darwin's theory is doubted by atheistic paleontologists. So I'm not relying on my own expertise, because I'm not a paleontologist. I'm deferring to the likes of Stephen Jay Gould, George Gaylord Simpson, and other paleontologists today. Now, that paleontologists debate and disagree. You know, is it we just haven't found the fossils between this one and that one? Or is it that they don't exist for some reason, because that bit of evolution happened on the land in a place where there's no deposition and therefore we're never going to find the fossils? Or is it a real record, actually, one minute we had this and then the next minute we had that, and there was really so little time in between? Yeah. I mean, geneticists have come up with sort of models of how it might happen, one of which was this sort of epigenetic effects and hopeful monsters. So the idea that somehow genes could throw out a big change. So that was, what's his name? Mine's gone blank. Wonderful Life. I'm just talking about him. Gould. So he was turning to some genetic theories to say, well, look, there could be genetic mechanisms by which there could be rapid change. Yes, yeah. In other words, the longer things go on, the more doubtful we become, because if every fossil that comes out, yeah. Sorry, I can't remember where. Let's keep going. Thank you for that. That's helpful. Okay, on to evolution and evolutionism. If evolution suggests that love is an illusion, how can it continue to be a central aspect of the Christian faith? I think I'm not trying to argue that evolution as a scientific theory is contradictory to the Christian faith. I think there's much evidence in the world around us that we believe in love, not for scientific reasons, but just because we think it's a reality in our relationships. It's evolutionism, so it's elevating evolution to an ideology which is the explanation of everything which contradicts the possibility of the existence of love. And I would deny evolutionism as being true. I can accept evolution as a scientific theory about some aspects of how plants and animals have come to be, including ourselves, but I'm not going to say that's all the truth that I can know about myself and the world around me. I think history, art, brings truth to us about our human predicament. So I wouldn't say that evolution suggests that love is an illusion. I would say that evolutionism, an ideology which believes that love is an illusion, suggests that, not evolution the science. How can what happens in the KT boundary tell us anything about my relationship with my wife? I don't think they can, really. Sorry, that we're getting a bit more polemical there, but come back at me on that. The philosopher Daniel Dennett argues that evolution is an acid that rots away at our values. Again, I wouldn't say that evolution, as if it's just a scientific theory about origins, doesn't necessarily rot away our values. How can the law of gravity rot away our values? It's evolutionism, elevating evolution to a place in society where it is the only truth, and it interprets all that we experience in terms of biological reproduction. Yes, that rots away our values, but not evolution. So does this suggest that to be an evolutionary theist potentially presents a problem, or is it the contrary, that the only way to stop the rot is to hold fast onto a belief in a purpose-giving deity? I think it's possible to hold on to belief in a purpose-giving deity who died on a cross for us and accept the scientific aspects of evolutionary theory. In fact, I'd go further to say that they fit rather well, that God shows his love most for us in something that looks pretty ugly, unjust, and horrible. Similarly, God brings out of what is chaotic and seems random and full of competition the most beautiful animals, plants, world around us. So I think that fits rather well. Do come back to me on those, whoever... I mean, Daniel Dennett would be in the same camp as Richard Dawkins, wouldn't he, as a philosopher and an atheist. So I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to say, look, evolution can be inflated into this value. So, yes, he would use evolution, as you've described it, but I would say that what he means by evolution is evolutionism. In other words, he's not saying evolution is this scientific endeavour which we can keep in the box of science. He is saying, as a philosopher, evolution is something we can extend, and therefore it suggests that we can explain everything according to this scientific theory, and therefore it rots values. So he's not countering that distinction, is he? No, I'd put Daniel Dennett very much in the New Atheists. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, easily done. He would put himself amongst the philosophers who support the New Atheist project. As far as I understand it, I don't know if I've got that wrong, if anybody knows that I've got that wrong. He would ally himself with A.C. Grayling, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens. Yeah. I mean, to be fair to them, they do recognise that if evolution is the only explanation, then we live in a terrible world, but they've got no answer. So the end of the selfish gene, Richard Dawkins would say, well, look, you know, life's awful then. If love is an illusion and justice is an illusion and there's no good or evil, then who'd want to live in the world? Well, we'll just have to try our best. But I think you need more philosophical weight to try your best against evil than just let's try our best. Onto the sort of faith things. Is not Genesis clear in its definition of time, i.e. a day, morning and evening, when speaking of creation? Now, obviously, Christians debate this, but just to say that there is a spectrum between Christians who take the Bible seriously, as I do, as an inerrant, infallible word of God, and yet I interpret it differently to those who say that they are six literal 24-hour days, because of Hebrews 4, for those of you who are interested, where the seventh day on which God rested from all the work of creating that he had done is still future for us. So that's a strange day if the seventh day of Genesis 1 is still, for those in time, future. Therefore, I can understand that is saying that this is not a six 24-hour days. The Bible, I would say, doesn't teach that. And I've got many theories as to why Christians believe that it does, but I won't go into those. Anybody want to? There's a number of questions actually here who fit into the same category. How can evolution be reconciled with Christian belief of fall and redemption through two historical persons, Adam and Eve? Or when did God breathe into the evolutionary record? What stage of monkeys became made in the image of God? Do you personally believe that people evolved from a common ancestor of apes? If so, when did we become made in God's image? How can the 6 days of creation be justified, the beginnings of man, Adam and Eve, and the date of this event? How can this relate to the current knowledge regarding early man? Which I think are all in its sort of same category. Well, if it's not 6 days, which I don't think the Bible teaches, and if the purpose of Genesis 1 is in the context of the culture of the time and needs to be carefully interpreted as such, then I don't personally have a problem with fitting a historical Adam and Eve, which, incidentally, I was first taught in the Department of Zoology by a Buddhist lecturer who was expounding the Adam and Eve hypothesis, which I don't know if you know is a genetic hypothesis that we're all descended from one human male and one human female. That's the first time I came across a historical Adam and Eve, although it's also taught in the church. So I don't have a problem with reconciling the historical Adam and Eve with some semblance of sort of Neolithic peoples. It's interesting that in Genesis 3, Cain and Abel, Cain doesn't like Abel, kills Abel, and then God speaks with Cain and says, right, I'm going to send you out to the land of Nod. And he says, well, don't do that, because all the people out there will find me and kill me. So what people? So hints that it may not be the correct reading of the early chapters of Genesis to think that Adam and Eve are the only possible hominids on the planet, but they are clearly the only two made that way by God for relationship with him, given his word. If you like, yes, that would be the moment in which God created, as I believe, as it says, a single human male and a single human female who were chosen out of those potential within that place and time to become. Now, God does that a lot, doesn't he? He chooses people out of a whole mass of other people. He did it with Abraham. He did it with the people of Israel. He does it today, choosing people to be part of his new world. So it fits with the overall sweep of Scripture. Go on. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's... Yeah. And that's fine. I mean, in terms of my thinking, I'm aware that I'm accepting the authority of the scriptures. I want to accept those things which are certain in science, and I'm putting the two together. The text of Genesis 3 does say that Cain is fearful of people that he will encounter when he goes into the land of Nod. So the only way around that would be to say, interpreting that text, would be to say, well, maybe he's got something in mind that somehow people are going to rapidly reproduce and go and live out there, and then he's going to be fearful of the people who will live there. I think that's stretching the text. So I'm trying to take the text seriously, and and see something that maybe hasn't been seen before because we didn't know what we now know today. And that's been the case in biblical interpretation throughout history, that often new discoveries in history or archaeology have informed the text. Doesn't mean we deny the text, but have informed our interpretation of the text. I don't think there's a way of dating because son of in Hebrew is very elastic as a term. So son of can mean one generation or 100 generations. So when the text says son of, doesn't mean the next in line was. And there seems to be flexibility in that term. So for somebody like Archbishop Usher, whenever he was, to calculate the date of creation and the date of Adam and Eve's creation on the basis of son of was a huge assumption which didn't accept what we now know about the Hebrew language, which he wouldn't have known because our texts and our understanding of Hebrew and Greek have improved over the last couple of centuries. But thank you. I can only something the Old Testament as an accurate. Well, I mean, that would be something to go back to the Old Testament, wouldn't it? And the Jesus claim that the history of the Old Testament and the nature of the Old Testament is, as he would put it, you know, not one little stroke of a Hebrew quill will disappear from the law or the Old Testament until he comes again. So Jesus' view of the Old Testament was heaven and earth will pass away, but the Old Testament won't pass away. That was his belief about that. So that, to take the view that the Old Testament is just a history of Judaism would disagree with Jesus. So if we assume that Jesus' words are authoritative, if we've got a Christian faith, then we'd want to examine that, I think. So he sees it as more significant than just a Jewish history. It's the history that points forward to him. If something like the Dead Sea Scrolls was discovered, which appeared to be accurate and true, which contradicted or disproved most of our understanding of Jesus and Christianity, what would you believe? Well, obviously it's hypothetical, but I think my answer would be, well, I'd need 15,000 of them before I change my mind. In other words, we've got 15,000 texts, translations, copies of the New Testament, of the witnesses of Jesus' life, death, resurrection. There was no organization. They were just under persecution in the first three centuries of the church. They were sort of rapidly disseminated across the Roman Empire, translated into Egyptian or Coptic, Persian. And we've got all those kinds of texts now today. So we're not just relying on one single text. And therefore, we can reconstruct the reliability of the text of the New Testament. So, yeah, if there was a text that came up and there was one of them, well, it would dent that, wouldn't it? But I need 15,000 before they're even on a par. And then I'd want to say, well, have they got their dating right? Was it written, like the Gnostic Gospels, some kind of mixture of Christianity and other claims? Do read the Gnostic Gospels, because they're clearly written much later. Even just by reading them, you can see that they're a fusion between Greek mystery religions and the Gospels, which were written much earlier. Not evidence that the New Testament is not reliable. I mean, that would be, I mean, single event speciations are usually confined to plants because of the way that plants work. So animals, there would need to be isolation of some kind in order there to be sufficient genetic difference or reproductive barrier. So I think that might be problematic. Yeah. And certainly there would be a sort of alignment between some scientific theories and Christian belief. There'd be misalignment with some scientific theories and other Christian beliefs, similarly as archaeology sometimes supports, sometimes undermines Christian belief. So, yeah, depends which one you trust more, I suppose. Other questions, though? Robin? Oh, sorry, we should really have a mic going around, because that would help people, wouldn't it? Do you want to grab a mic? It's not fair for me to have one.
Thank you, it works. It's very loud. How much do you think, this is a slightly different question, how much do you think Dawkins, for example, is using evolutionism or evolution as a lever to prop up the great social wrongs that we can see increasing across the world today?
I'm not sure that he is socially motivated. I think he feels passionately as a scientist. I think he feels passionately as an atheist that belief in anything other than what he believes in is just wrong. So I'm not sure it's really on his radar. Now, I may be being unfair to him there. I mean, clearly, a particular view of the world can tend towards a more compassionate treatment of people or a less compassionate treatment of people. I would argue that evolutionism tends towards a less compassionate treatment of people. And I'm not sure whether Richard Dawkins accepts that. I just don't know. I haven't come across anything that he's written where he brings in a sort of social justice as a concern. I mean, I may be wrong, but I don't think I've come across anything. He admits it's a problem. What's interesting is that his philosophy is percolating throughout our society and is meaning that our laws are being changed towards the direction of evolutionism. So I think in terms of the judiciary, I don't know if you come across recent judgments that were made on the basis of evolutionary ideology, not expressed as such, but just to say that particular ethical concerns have a particular judgment in a secular way, and that all other faith positions do not have a right to challenge that. So if that was rolled out into other situations, then yes, but...
It's just like things like social Darwinism, for example, saying things like there is not enough room for people on the planet or that poverty is inevitable, these sort of things, seems to harmonise quite well with the idea of evolutionism. And also the idea of religion or a god, for example, seems to make him quite insecure about some of these things. It just feels like that.
I don't know where he's coming from, but certainly I think in terms of a value system, or if evolutionism as an ideology tends in a particular direction, it would tend away from social cohesion because it emphasises the individual and survival, not cooperation. In other words, group selection, any notion that evolution works on in the group is denied and explained away by selfishness. So family cohesion, national cohesion, all these things would be explained in terms of individual genetic reproduction. So it tends away from social Darwinism, which is really more of a sort of 19th century thing. Does that answer your question? Rob and I have spent many hours talking about these things, but it's been great.
Concern about the God exists in the gap. So he put a picture up which had kind of leaves and then lots of dotted lines. And my fear is that, you know, in 50 years' time, some of those things will be filled in, and then something which became a sort of basis of your faith disappears overnight.
Sorry, I haven't made myself clear, but thank you for raising that. What I'm arguing is not that the gaps in the fossil record are evidence for God, and that somehow God has sort of stepped in to make these things happen. What I'm saying is that Darwin's theory predicts that there should be lots of intermediate fossils, and therefore the fact that there's a gap there casts doubt on Darwin's theory of evolution. So my evidence for God is not drawn from a particular evolutionary theory, whether it works or not. Evidence for God, I would suggest, is more intuitive, which we all experience. I think even Richard Dawkins has experienced, and therefore is appealing to a different body of knowledge than to science, which I think is legitimate, because if science is to do with matter and impersonal laws, if God is not material and not impersonal, then, of course, science has nothing to say about the existence or not of God. So I'm sorry if I haven't made that clear, but the gaps that I was referring to in the fossil record are evidence that Darwin's theory is not necessarily as watertight as many people believe, nor evidence for the existence of God. So sorry not to make that clear.
So what would Dawkins say about it? If it's such a such an amazing thing, which is such a big problem. Dawkins must have addressed it in some way.
The sort of, you've got two kinds of evolutionist. Okay, so Stephen Jay Gould is an atheist and set up punctuated equilibrium. He doesn't think the fossil record supports Darwin's theory. He's an atheist, though. Richard Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould didn't get on, both atheists, but arguing over the nature of the fossil record and whether it was evidence for gradual evolution as opposed to rapid evolution. So you've got the Christian Simon Conway Morris coming in on Richard Dawkins' side, and you've got other atheists coming in. So there's a lot of debate. I guess the reason why I was raising all this is just to say we can't even agree on the mechanism of evolution. So is it right to be building a philosophy, an ideology of the whole of life based on something we're not quite sure about, atheists and Christians? So Richard Dawkins would quite confidently say that his sort of strain of evolution is correct and is about as in as much doubt as the Earth going around the sun. And I just have to say, that's just not true. Would you, I mean, a geologist, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I think I'd hold the view. I was pretty comfortable when I came out of university because I did a lot of, I was lectured by Simon Conway Morris, for example.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I had a bit about him. I would say that I kind of liked the idea of punctuated equilibrium because I think in continuous conformable rocks, you see that. You know, I still do that job today. You can go through and you can see very gradual, subtle changes to these little beasties, and you'd be looking at literally fine changes in their anatomy. And then suddenly they'll change, and you will see that. And you can see that even in conformable sections of the stratigraphy. You see, so, but I've got to the point now where I've just got rid of my dogma on this because I don't. I'd be happy, you know. I'd always say to someone, "Well, yeah, scientific observation would suggest okay, punctuated equilibrium is a reasonable mechanism. Equally, God could have just stepped in and done it." And that's my.
I'm not saying that. Just to sort. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
Some would go down that, but I think that's a cop out. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I know you're not saying that.
Yeah,
I'm kind of saying that. Given my reading of the Bible, I would say that quite often God does step in. Some of his miracles, you can kind of say, okay, yes, you can come up with a scientific, rational explanation for them, like the parting of the Red Sea, for example, and the timing's the miraculous part of it. But then there's other things you kind of say, well, possibly not. That's just supernatural. And so I kind of think God could have acted supernaturally alongside evolution.
Any more questions? I think time marches on, and we probably want to be going by about 10, don't we? So unless there's any other questions, can I just say thank you very much for coming? Just to say that there are lots of books. These are not for sale. They're all mine, and I want to have them available to me in the future. But I thought I'd bring them just so that you can see some of the books from which I've drawn some of the things I've been talking about. They're from all sides, really. Intelligent Design, Dawkins' books, Answers to Stephen Hawking. So there's quite a range. So do come and browse these. And also to say that we run a course at the church here called Christianity Explored. It's a course where people can come just ask any question they want. We read through one of the Gospels. I know some of you here have already done that. If you're interested in just being kept informed about when those courses are happening, do just give your email and we'll keep you informed if that would be something you might be interested in. But I think that's it. So thank you very much for coming, and I hope you've enjoyed it.